Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case of the morning is Continental Insurance against Chase Manhattan Mortgage. Mr. Klein.
May it please the court. I would like to begin discussing this morning the October 11 order of dismissal entered by the district court. It began with a 5 o'clock filing 2 days before on October 9th with two voluminous motions to dismiss on grounds of alleged and purported discovery sanctions. October 11th at 8:45 in the morning, we filed our 23-page brief with 21 exhibits attached. At the beginning of the hearing, we asked the district judge to read our brief and the attachments. He refused. At a second point during the course of the hearing, we again asked the district judge to read our submissions, which included an affidavit of counsel under penalty of perjury.
Did he ask you to orally read counsel?
Yes, he did, Your Honor. And then he paid no attention, Your Honor, to what we had said orally or in the brief. Because
how do you know he didn't pay any attention to what you said orally?
Your Honor, at the end of the hearing, without giving any reason, the judge dismissed the case with prejudice for discovery sanctions. Later the same day, the district judge issued a two-page order and gave five reasons. None of those five reasons are in any respect supported by the factual record. He could not have read our brief. He could not have read our discovery responses. And I'll go one by one through the five. The 4,500 remaining contracts, he said in his order, and I will quote at page 2, no documents relating to the 4,500 remaining account debtor contracts have been produced by Continental, end quote. That's false, and it is demonstrably false. On September 18th, 23 days earlier, there was a conference call among all counsel, and we said to the defendants, the 4,500 files are in 80 boxes, and they are ready for your review. Do you want to review them before they're bait stamped or afterwards? They said, and both of them said, we'll get back to you, and they never did. So when Judge Alicia said that we had failed to produce them, that's false. That's erroneous. Secondly,
when the district court ordered the production of these documents on which you are not suing, why did the district court say that they were appropriate for discovery?
He did not, Your Honor. He never gave any explanation as to why they were appropriate.
I will confess, maybe the other side will need to discuss this, but I don't understand why discovery ought to include other contracts on which you're not suing.
Your Honor, I could not agree more. That was our position, which was why we objected to those discovery requests. We already had 550 contracts in issue. We were not suing on 4,500. It was irrelevant. It was not calculated to lead to the discovery of admissible evidence. It was certainly burdensome and oppressive, and the district judge on September 18th never even gave us a chance to argue the objection. He, in an omnibus order, overruled every one of our discovery objections without articulating any basis for why the objection was not appropriate. So we don't have a clue to this day, Your Honor, and the district judge did not provide us with one either. Mm-hmm. The second point was that on September 27th, again with the 4,500 contracts, we served counsel with amended discovery responses, and we said we will produce those 4,500 contracts. How, therefore, could the district judge have read our brief, read our affidavit, or read our discovery responses, and then say that we refused to produce them? That is why, Judge Caney, we know that he never read our brief, he never read the affidavits of the 20 exhibits, and he never read our discovery responses. On the second point, on the same issue, following up, Judge Caney, with your question, the judge said that we refused to bait stamp documents. Again, had he read our discovery responses, which referred specifically to bait stamped documents, he would have seen that that statement was incorrect. He did not read the record. The third point, he said we had not identified underwriting standards or policy provisions in the contract which had been breached. Again, false. We specifically identified for the defendants the precise paragraphs in the indemnification policy which were breached. There are many other parts of this, but when we look at it in the two-page order, we know that what was happening on October 11th was really a repetition of what had happened on September 27th when we asked for 2 days to file a brief in opposition to a motion to bar our expert witness in order to apprise the district court of the court opinion in the Sherrod versus Lingle case, which Your Honor Judge Caney wrote, and in order to apprise Judge Alicia of his own opinion in the Spearman case, issued in April of 2001, following Sherrod. On that instance, he followed the court's ruling. On September 27th, when we asked for 2 days to respond to what was in essence a dispositive motion, he rejected our request. September 18th, going to Judge Easterbrook's question, we asked for 3 days to file an opposition to voluminous motions to compel in order precisely, Your Honor, Judge Easterbrook, to explain why these were objectionable requests, why they were neither relevant nor calculated to lead, and why the case was going off on a tangent. He refused to allow us to file a brief at that time either. It's a very sad situation that we face and that I think our system faces when we have a district judge who will not read what is presented to him, who will not listen to counsel either in writing or orally, because our oral statements were rejected out of hand without his going to the record either.
The fact that you made oral statements or had it in the record doesn't necessarily mean he didn't read them because he didn't include it in his order. That doesn't necessarily follow.
Your Honor, I agree with that. Had he given us a full and fair hearing, and had he addressed those issues either in court or in a written order, we would be able to say with some confidence that, yes, the district judge acted like a judge. He listened, and he thought, and he considered. What we did have instead was a district court who was acting in an arbitrary, unfettered manner, and it's my view that he felt he had so much authority from the decisional law that this court has rendered over the years that no one would ever abuse him, would ever reverse him on abuse of discretion grounds. Whether or not he read what was submitted, whether or not he entered an order that was based upon the factual record. And that's what happened here.
How much of this do you think centered on his determination of the discovery deadline that you had abused? Was that the linchpin for throwing this case out?
The expert witness issue, Your Honor?
Well, yes. When the October 31st, the date that he specified, and you interpreted it one way and he another.
We all knew, Your Honor, that October 31st was the all-discovery deadline because that's what Judge Alicia had said and that's what his order said. The question became, on September 27th, did all discovery, including experts, mean not all discovery, including experts? Because the question became, under Sherrod and under his own decision in Spearman, when was expert disclosure required? We tried to point out to him that under Rule 26, if the court orders otherwise, which the court certainly had done on June 5th by saying all discovery, including experts, then the 90-day rule is inapplicable. Because that's the default mechanism.
In the June 5th discussion, the attorneys presented what they thought was a reduced schedule or a shortened schedule and put out a sequence, including dates for expert testimony, expert witness disclosure. And then the end of it, I think, was December 31st.
October 31st, Your Honor.
Well, that was of your proposal. And then he said, no, it's going to be October 31st. And that, I think, is at least where, in my view, where this confusion comes in, where he says that that's not short enough. Let's make it October 31st, and that's going to include expert witnesses. And the date for filing the final pretrial order will be in open court November 27th. And he says, again, the plaintiff submits plaintiff's expert's report, and then defendant submits the defendant's, and you can get it all done before October 31st.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor.
You interpreted that as being able to present your expert's name and his report and whatever all before the 31st?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because then on the October 27th, is that right?
No, October 9th.
September 27th.
Yes, Your Honor.
That's when he declares that you interpreted it wrong.
Yes.
That was the end of depositions. You were supposed to do everything else within the 90-day requirement.
That's correct.
That is the dispute, I guess, at least on that issue.
Yes, that's the dispute, because on September 27th, the district judge reinterpreted his June 5th order to say something that it did not say, because the order in court that you just read from, Your Honor, Judge Mannion, and in writing, in the minute order, said October 31st, deadline for all discovery, including experts. And then on September 27th, he said, well, I meant August 27th there for the disclosure of experts' reports with depositions to be concluded by October 31st. That's not what he said in court. That's not what the written order said. And that's not what this court has said in Schrodt or Judge Alicia said in Spearman either. So we had a situation where he thought that we had violated his order, which we had not. He refused to listen to our explanation.
The reports are not disclosed until the end of discovery. How can the deposition to the experts occur by the end of discovery?
Your Honor, that's an excellent question. There would be, most certainly, a logistical problem if on October 31st...
No. The violation of the laws of nature. You would have to have time running backward. That doesn't really happen.
I agree with Your Honor. In Sherrod, this court said that the deadline for all discovery meant disclosure of experts. But that wouldn't have afforded anybody time to take the deposition. So we never would have taken this up to October 31st, and we didn't. We submitted our experts report on October 9th, and the defendants had said that they could have submitted their report within 10 days during our June conference before Judge Alicia. But you're right, Judge Easterbrook, that had we done it on October 31st, there would have had to have been a joint motion to reopen or the cooperation of counsel to have those depositions proceed after the discovery closed. I'd like to, with the court's permission, save my remaining time for rebuttal.
Certainly, Mr. Klein. Ms. O'Donnell.
May it please the court, Margo Wolf O'Donnell on behalf of defendants. Judge Alicia's order reflects what occurred in the lower court. It's consistent with the record. Judge Alicia's order recognized that Continental had failed to provide breach information for at least half of the contracts that they contended to be at issue. In their supplemental interrogatory responses, Continental set forth a chart purportedly listing the breaches for all 550 of the contracts allegedly at issue. However, for 191 of those contracts, Continental listed no breach whatsoever. For 93 of those contracts...
Why, on your view, was it appropriate to dismiss the entire case as opposed to foreclosing claims with respect to which there had been incomplete disclosure?
Because Continental had engaged in dilatory tactics and had repeatedly violated this court's orders and the federal rules of civil procedure.
It hadn't violated this court's orders.
And violated the lower court's orders. It violated the September 18th order by failing to fully respond to defendant's discovery. It failed to provide any mitigation information in response to Auto One's interrogatories number 8 and 9 and Chase's interrogatory number 2F. It failed to provide any response whatsoever to Auto One's interrogatory number 11. It failed to verify its responses until October 9th. On the eve of the sanction motion, and when it did verify its responses, it did so through a witness that had never been previously revealed, Robert Mann. And because deposition...
What's wrong with these things? And the close of discovery was still sometime in the future. Why was it worthy of dismissing the litigation that responses were verified by a witness first revealed a month before the close of discovery?
It's worth dismissing the case because of Continental's pattern of violating this court's orders, and also because when all of this discovery came in, it was evident that they did not have any claims here. In addition to not being able to set forth any breach information for 191 of the contracts, with the remaining contracts, they did not set forth any viable basis for breach as well. With 93 of the contracts, they claimed that there was an underwriting violation, but they weren't able to set forth any contractual basis for the underwriting violation. They weren't able to point to any underwriting guidelines that the parties had agreed to.
So then they lose on those.
That sounds like a ground for summary judgment, not for dismissing the case as a discovery sanction.
But at this point, we were in discovery, and they had done so in violation of the September 18th order. And with respect to the remaining claims, they claimed that defendants failed to timely forward loan documents, but they failed to point to any provision in the policy that required defendants to do so. So the entirety of their claims, all 550 of their
court
claims...
District Court said that the reason he was dismissing it, because he thought the plaintiffs were intransigent, and the reason he gave why he believed the plaintiffs were intransigent is that they had even refused to put sequential number stamps on the documents. Is that a factual statement? Had they refused to put sequential number stamps on the documents?
Well, their refusal to put the sequential numbers, he was referencing their refusal to reference specific documents in response to interrogatories going to the heart of their claim.
That's a completely different claim from the claim that they had refused to apply base stamps to the documents. Totally different to say, we'd applied these stamps, but we did not correctly identify documents in response to particular requests. The district court, it's only two pages long, and this supposed refusal to apply Bates stamps seems to play a prominent role. I just want to be sure I understand your position. Do you think it is factually true that the plaintiffs had refused to apply Bates stamps to their documents?
Yes, I do. In their August 24th letter, they set forth their position that they would not be Bates stamping their documents.
Okay, so if we look in the record, we will find that these documents do not have Bates stamps.
The documents did have Bates stamps because upon their refusal to Bates stamp, we Bates stamped their documents.
You marked them and not them?
Yes, we did mark them.
Somebody here is not telling us the truth.
What happened was is that Continental...
One set of lawyers here is lying to us, mm-hmm. and we will figure out which.
Could I explore the same thing I did with
yes.
the other counsel? That when I read this in context mm-hmm. with what you both presented, sort of a sequential... suggested deadline with December 31st, all the judge changed was September. He moved it to October 31st.
Correct.
Why then is there some presumption that he inserted the 90-day rule? He didn't say anything about that. It's, in fact, in the context where he read it, he seemed to have kind of a tight sequence, expert, and it's pretty short. And not only that, I think I read somewhere where another objection was that in this last 2 or 3 weeks, you had quite a number of depositions scheduled in different states.
Yes,
so
we did.
So you're observing this deadline with, did you say 15 depositions?
Yes, we did.
15 depositions in 2 weeks in several states in the last 2 weeks before October 31st. So it's not like you didn't look at that October 31st as the deadline either.
Well, we had our deposition scheduled prior to the October 31st deadline, and Continental made no mention of an expert to be deposed during that period of time until their September 24th letter.
But you couldn't depose them because they had all these other schedules. And
correct.
So they're now got a crunch, and no question is a problem here, but is it enough to merit dismissing the case and that level of a sanction?
Well, I think that the district court needed to have an option to do so if one of the parties, such as Continental, repeatedly violated his orders and repeatedly violated the federal rules of civil procedure.
But when I read that order, the June 5th, versus how he interpreted it on September 27th, I have to say, just in reading it and thinking about it, it doesn't look very clear to me that October 31st wasn't the deadline and that they were operating within it. Tight, yes, then cramming it down the last minute like everybody seemed to do. Not good, but nevertheless within his directive. And then he says, no, I meant depositions by then. Well, he didn't say that.
Well, the court made no ruling as to expert discovery so that the 90-day rule applied. He set a pretrial order date, a ready-for-trial date of November 27th.
Yeah, but you, wait a minute. You sent out a proposal and included experts, and all he did was instead of December 31st, he said October 31st. He didn't.
Yeah.
And in that context, it seems to me he was sort of approving whatever your schedule was, only December 31st wasn't going to be the last day.
No, he said that all discovery, including expert discovery, must be completed by October 31st, but he said nothing about the date scheduled for expert discovery. And Continental, we certainly would have been amenable to working out a schedule of Continental, with Continental if they had approached us. Also, Continental could have gone in on a motion to set a discovery schedule, or they could have complied with Rule 26, but they did none of those things.
Is there a standing order also that plays into this in the district court?
The Judge Alicia's standing order does not make reference to expert discovery, such that we were operating under a discovery cutoff of October 31st and a pretrial order date of November 27th.
Did the standing order play any part in this whole discovery matter?
It played a part in the discovery motions. The standing order specifically states that discovery motions may be ruled on without a responsive brief. It may be ruled on by oral argument. Continental also references in their brief that they couldn't respond to some of defendants' discovery because they did not have defendants' documents. But defendants forwarded their documents to Continental upon making claims under the policy, such that Continental had defendants' documents for up to 10 years. Also, if you review Continental's discovery responses, you find that they only make this objection with respect to two interrogatories. And those interrogatories go to the heart of their claim, and they should have had this information upon the inception of the lawsuit. Those interrogatories are, what policy provisions did defendants breach with respect to each account, and what action or inaction did defendants take in violation of the policy with respect to each account? Additionally, Continental's expert only mentions one of defendants' documents in its report, Auto One's practice manual, and he also states in his report that that document is irrelevant.
How long have you been negotiating this issue prior to the inception of the suit?
Approximately a year. Additionally, defendants made their documents available at the same time as Continental. Although Continental claims that they made their documents available in May, that is false and unsupported in the record. Continental made its documents available after the entry of the protective order on September 4th. Continental also did not produce a database until September 7th, and Continental admits in its brief that it had this database prior to the inception of the lawsuit, but chose not to produce it to defendants until after the entry of the protective order.
When you look at the brief, it looks like you're almost talking about two different cases. What you say and what they say about time, when things were available, they notified you can do look at this, do that, and it just seems like nobody's paying attention. It's very difficult to look at it just from this brief standpoint. That's why, obviously, we give deference to district courts.
Well, defendants, upon Continental's request, timely supplemented their discovery responses. Continental requested supplemental responses at the end of June, and defendants supplemented their responses pursuant to their request on July 6th and July 9th. And then defendants never heard from Continental again on the issue. Upon receipt of Continental's discovery, in which Continental objected to virtually every one of the interrogatories that defendants had propounded and referred defendants to 30 boxes of documents and to the database that they had not yet produced, defendants filed a motion to compel, asking the judge to rule on the improper objections and the improper use of Rule 33D. The judge then reprimanded Continental and informed them that it was improper to refer to documents without specifying where those documents may be found. Because Continental had asserted a case for 550 separate contracts, Judge Alicia recognized that defendants were entitled to breach information with respect to each of those contracts, mitigation information with respect to each of those contracts. Also, Continental failed to respond to Auto One's interrogatory number 11 in violation of this court's September 18th order, and that involved the remaining account debtor contracts, which defendants had argued that they were entitled to because that information would enable them to determine the criteria that Continental used in selecting the 550 contracts at issue.
Why is that legally relevant?
Because
let's suppose that they simply reached into an urn with 5,000 balls and drew out 500 and they sued on the 500. What skin is that off your client's nose? Looks like your client should be happy that they didn't draw out any more. But I can't see why that would be legally relevant.
Because defendants made claims on 5,000 contracts, and those 5,000...
No, they're only making claims on 550.
Defendants submitted claims to Continental on 5,000 contracts. Continental is making claims on 550 of those contracts. Defendants have no idea what criteria they used or why they selected those 500.
You haven't answered my question. Why is it legally relevant?
Because the 4,500 files could show the party's course of conduct to explain any ambiguity in the policy. It could show the party's course of conduct.
I don't get it. Do you think you would have a defense if it turned out that the 500 contracts on which suit is filed are materially identical to the 4,500 contracts on which suit was not filed?
Well, I think that if those 4,500 contracts show that we forwarded the loan files in the same time frame as we forwarded the loan files on the 550 contracts, it would show that what we did with respect to the 550 was consistent with the party's course of conduct.
But so what? The plaintiff's argument seems to be that what was done with respect to the 500 contracts was improper. Now, if your client violated the plaintiff's rights with respect to 5,000 contracts and they sued on only 10%, what skin is that off your client's nose? That's the question I'm trying to ask.
Because the policy is patently ambiguous. The provisions of the policy that it argued, the Continental argued
that... In that event, you can win on the 500 contracts. It looks to me, maybe I'm being too subtle, it looks to me like you're engaged in the common tactic of trying to ramp up discovery costs for the purpose of obstructing a case. Now, the district judge never explained why, in his view, the discovery burden had to be increased by a factor of 10. It doesn't look to me like there's any legal significance to the 90% of the discovery materials that is at stake here. If you have some reason why there's legal significance to them, I'd really like to hear it.
Well, I think that the discovery at issue here is legally significant. It fails to provide any information as to how we breached the policy with respect to the contracts at issue. So
now that's with respect to the 500 contract.
Right.
I'm looking for an explanation about why it is legally significant, calculated to lead to the admission of admissible evidence, to increase the discovery burden from 500 contracts to 5,000 contracts.
Because one of the party's affirmative defenses was that we acted consistently with the party's course of conduct.
And if that's not an affirmative defense, what happens?
Well, then, we believe that those files were relevant to explain ambiguities in the policy. And
I don't see how the contracts can explain ambiguities on the face of an insurance policy.
Because the insurance policy provided the provision that they claimed we violated, defendants violated, mm-hmm. was that we did not act in a professional manner. So what we did with respect to the entirety of the pool of contracts would inform as to what we did, whether what we did was actually professional or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. O'Donnell. Anything further, Mr. Klein?
Let me go right to the 4,500 files. Your Honor, it was discovery abuse quintessentially, because we made those available on September 18th. We said to them, they're available. When do you want to look at them? Do you want them bait stamped? Do you want to look at them before they go out for bait stamping? They said, we'll get back to you. And they never asked to see a single page of the 4,500 contracts in 80 boxes. And the reason they never asked was because they never wanted to look at them, but they wanted to have an opportunity to go back to Judge Alicia and say, dismiss the case. They didn't want those documents. They didn't want to look at them, and their conduct proved that. Second, we made our 550 files available to them in May of 2001, 2 months before they ever served a document request upon us. How is that dilatory conduct? In the record,
What about the bait stamp issue where they said they stamped them and you said you stamped?
That's not correct, Your Honor. The parties engaged in the same process which Ms. Garcia's verification under oath under penalty of perjury, which has never been contradicted by the defendants.
Somebody is not giving us a straight story.
Your Honor,
how in your view are we going to figure out who is telling it to us straight?
Your Honor, I would ask the court to do what Judge Alicia never did, and that is to read the record below. Because
how is the record going to show who stamped the document?
The record will show Ms. Garcia's verification under penalty of perjury that the parties exchanged.
We just had comment from counsel at this podium saying the opposite.
Well, it was never contradicted in the district court, Your Honor. And Ms. Garcia said, and it was true, that all parties exchanged non-base stamp documents, and only after they wanted documents to be reproduced, to be copied, would they then be sent out for base stamping. We base stamped the documents. We identified those base stamp documents. I'm looking at page 124 of our appendix, interrogatory answers. We specified them. We did it consistently all the way through. The September 18th conversation, which again is reflected in Ms. Garcia's verification, says we will produce 80 boxes to you now without base stamps, or if you want them base stamped, they'll be sent out.
It may be understandable, Judge Alicia's mood and attitude with regard to discovery, given the arguments we've had today. This is a kind of discovery dispute that takes enormous time for the court.
Your Honor, everybody hates discovery disputes. District court judges, judges on this court, and lawyers. But that doesn't mean that a judicial officer can refuse to read what's submitted to him, which would show that we complied with discovery in good faith. We got ahead of the curve. We're the plaintiff in this case. It's in our interest to produce the discovery, which we did before our discovery was requested of us. We gave them data sheets. We gave them a Microsoft electronic database with letters explaining how they could utilize that. And they never looked at any of it because they didn't want to reach the merits. And we got kicked out without the merits ever having been faced. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Klein. The case will be taken under advisement.